and give their attention as the court is now sitting. Back to the United States and this honorable court.
Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is Paschal Electric Company versus International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Mr. Martone.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Andy Martone and I represent the appellants in this case, Ronald Smart and Paschal Electric. Present in the gallery are the three gentlemen who assisted me with the preparation of today's argument, the Reverend Johnny Scott from the East St. Louis NAACP, Mr. Ron Smart, and Mr. Robert Thompson. In this case, Paschal Electric and Ronald Smart asked that this court overturn the district court's granting of summary judgment against it by the lower court. Specifically, the lower court granted summary judgment in favor of the defendant appellees, IBEW Local 702, on appellant's claims of discrimination under Section 1981 and Title VII. The lower court also granted summary judgment in favor of Local 702 on its counterclaim to enforce an arbitration award. I'm going to ask the court's forgiveness at this stage because I'm laboring under a sinus infection, and so if I appear fumble-tongued, please forgive me. I'm also going to take the issues in the reverse order that they were addressed by the district court, given the lack of time in terms of going through the entire record. And I'm going to discuss the discrimination aspect first. The lower court ruled that there was not sufficient evidence of discrimination sufficient to sustain a claim of race discrimination under either Section 1981 or under Title VII. Now, we respectfully disagree. I'm not going to go through a complete recitation of the facts, but what I'll do is I'll discuss each of the pieces of evidence, I believe, of discrimination that exist in the record today. A brief chronology shows that in July of 1998, appellants approached IBEW Local 702. They signed a letter of assent with the union, and they also at that point signed Robert Thompson, an employee who's an African American, up with the union. They registered him. They inquired when Thompson could attend an apprenticeship training course, and they also inquired about participation in what's called the Target Program. And a target program is essentially a program under which union contractors can get supplemental money to assist them in bidding against non-union contractors who have lower wage rates. In that meeting, they were told that the target forms would be forthcoming, that Thompson would be initiated into the union, and that, and in addition, that Thompson would be admitted to the apprenticeship training program. The party's collective bargaining agreement, which Your Honor will find in the joint and supplemental appendix at page 7, specifies that employees should have to join the union within 8 days of joining the company. In this case, Thompson was not permitted to join the union or signed into the union in 8 days as a contract.
Is there any evidence of record that individuals of a different race were sworn in at an early or a quicker pace?
No, Your Honor, there's not, because those records don't exist. They do not keep track of individuals in terms of when they're sworn in, or at least in discovery.
As the record shows, this just may have been lethargy on the part of the union in handling its affairs generally.
That might be true, Your Honor, but for the fact that Ron Smart called the union repeatedly in an attempt to get Thompson both sworn into the union and admitted to the apprenticeship training school. It took until October of that year for Thompson to actually be sworn into the union.
Again, is there any evidence that any other employer was treated better than this gentleman and his corporation were?
Not with respect to the issue of swearing Thompson in, Your Honor.
How about with respect to the apprenticeship program, or with respect to the program that assists the employer with respect to getting non-union contracts?
The union does not keep records, or at least they asserted in discovery, they do not keep records of when employees request target forms, who bids for target forms. They only keep records of who's awarded target forms, and so we couldn't develop that evidence in discovery. What we do have evidence of, though, is we have evidence that shortly after Thompson was initiated into the union, it was again promised he'd be able to attend the training course. Ron Smart called the union 16 times in an attempt to get him admitted into the course and in an attempt to get the target funds. The union never returned a single one of those phone calls. The parties, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Oh, please.
The parties' collective bargaining agreement specifies that an employer is only allowed to have an apprentice, which Thompson would have been, if that apprentice is enrolled in the apprenticeship training course. And so this had the effect under the terms of the contract of forbidding Pasco Electric from using Thompson.
Mr. Martone, can you give us a sense of what you believe the necessary prima facie case is that your client had to make under this specific section of Title 7? And we don't usually deal with this specific section of Title 7, and the law is not as well developed with respect to what is a prima facie case. Could I have your view on that, please?
I think in this case, Your Honor, we can make a prima facie case under one of two ways. I think first we can provide direct evidence of discrimination, and I'll argue to the court that there is some of that direct evidence present in this case. I also believe that the McDonnell-Douglas proof can essentially be shoehorned into the same type of evidence we're talking about.
It would be helpful to me if you could show me how you would shoehorn it.
Certainly. In this case, the collective bargaining agreement specifies that employees who join an employer who's signatory to the contract are required to join the union within 8 days. Thompson not only was not required to or asked to join the union in 8 days, but he was not permitted to join the union until his employer repeatedly asked. And so we have a contract that requires conduct on one hand, and we have different conduct by Local 702 on the other hand. In addition, and this is probably a little bit more of the type of evidence Your Honor is asking for, in this case, after Ron Smart repeatedly insisted that Thompson be admitted to the union, that Thompson be admitted to the apprenticeship training program, the response, other than to not admit Thompson and to not send Smart the target forms, was to triple Ron Smart's dues. We have evidence of two similarly situated contractors who were treated differently. And the only distinction on the record is the fact that Pasco Electric employed an African-American and they did not.
So with respect to the level of dues, you do have evidence of disparate treatment.
Yes, Your Honor, we do.
That's the only area, though, where you have it, right?
That's the only area we have it, because that's the only area where there are records, Your Honor.
And the union has not been able to come up, as I understand it, with any evidence that those two guys were exceptions and that they usually do require the higher dues.
The union put an affidavit with a due schedule into the record, but the record is devoid of evidence of other contractors who were treated the same way that they treated Ronald Smart.
Can we go back to an antecedent issue, and that is sure. Whether or not your client really can bring an action under this section of Title VII. How does your client have standing to do that?
In my view, Your Honor, I think the Supreme Court addressed that admittedly in dicta in the Northwest Airlines case when they said, we assume that there are circumstances in which an employer may be a person aggrieved by union conduct that would be remediable after a timely charge is filed against the union. In this case, the section at issue forbids unions to make employers or attempt to cause employers to discriminate. Given that, it is the employer who suffers the injury. It is the employer who is the aggrieved party. And so I think the employer must be the party who has standing, because otherwise you would have a wrong without a remedy.
And I guess you would rely on Traficante then for the proposition that injury under Title VII, as under Title VIII, is to be construed as broadly as possible, commensurate with Article III restrictions.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
I see.
Yeah, I see that I've come to my rebuttal time. May I reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal?
Sure.
Okay, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Martone. Mr. Hex?
Your Honors, my name is Chris Hexer. I'm here on behalf of International Brotherhood of Electric Workers, Local 702. Mr. Martone, in his argument, focused on the 1981 and Title VII issues, not the arbitration issues. So I'll respond first to his argument. I would assume that he's almost conceding the argument or the court's opinion on the arbitration award.
I don't think he conceded anything.
Well, then I'll respond just basically. He didn't argue it here. I would just say that
because he was working in a shortage of time and he went back to
fair enough, Your Honor. I would just say that with regard to the arbitration award, Your Honors, the award with the law being that arbitration awards are entitled to full deference by the courts. In this case, there was no problems with the procedures that were followed. There was notice given to Pasco Electric and Mr. Smart. They appeared at the arbitration hearing. They were they've appeared with an attorney. They were able to present their arguments. They were bound to a contract by the letters of assent that Pasco Electric had signed. The contracts provided for fringe benefit payments. The fringe benefit payments were not made. That is what the board found. The board.
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor.
What about the disparate treatment of the other two contractors?
Your Honor, the other two contractors, the evidence is that the other two contractors were not working near the hours that Mr. Smart was working. That is what that was the evidence presented to the district court, and that is what the district court found. In this case, the union has bylaws which state that if you are a contractor and you work, and there is no dispute that Mr. Smart worked with tools, that there is a imposition of what are called working dues. In fact, in this case, the union prospectively imposed those dues. There was no requirement. The union did not go back and say, look, you haven't paid dues for months before. We're simply letting you know, having learned this, that we are now imposing those dues prospectively.
Besides Mr. Smart and these two gentlemen, were there any others who were employer owners of entities but yet were working?
I simply don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I don't think there was any evidence one way or the other of that below, either that there was discovery asked for and produced by Pasco Electric or that Local 7 produced that. So I don't know the answer to that.
So
I do know that there's the bylaw.
You're really then up against a situation where your opponent says, well, I've been singled out. I'm the only guy they charge the higher dues to. Didn't charge it to the other two fellows. Your response apparently is, well, the other two fellows didn't work as much. Is there any provision that you can point to that makes that necessary distinguishing characteristic between those two people? And
well, I don't know if the bylaw simply says that that a contractor working with tools and working a substantial time is required to pay working dues. In fact, the only evidence that was submitted, I don't think there was any evidence below other than hearsay, a statement by Mr. Smart that he had observed those contractors working, but there was no submission of any showing or discovery or deposition testimony admitted by Mr. Smart or Pasco Electric that showed that these contractors were working, and the union's position is that they were not working contractors the way Mr. Smart had admitted that he was in the deposition that was taken of him.
Does the record show whether Local 702 has other black members?
Yes, it does. And I think, I can't remember the exact statistics, but I think there was evidence that there are about 77 African-American members of Local 702.
How many members in the local?
I believe there's approximately 1,000 to 1,500 members. I don't know what that is proportional to the area of the state.
Now, with respect to Title VII,
yes.
Are you contesting the standing of
yes.
Pasco Electric to bring an action under
yes.
Title VII?
And that was the finding of the district court. He's not an employer.
Okay. On what grounds?
He's not an employee.
On what could you explain the basis?
Well,
given the fact that there is a specific provision in Title VII that deals with pressure on employers, and given the fact that Title VII has been interpreted as broadly as it
is. My understanding is that the Supreme Court addressed this issue in the Northwest Airlines case and simply found that employers are not entitled to the protections of Title VII, that the protections extend to employees who are discriminated against. Mr. Smart is an employer, Pasco Electric is an employer, and therefore is not entitled to the protections of Title VII. You have to find protections in some other statute, but Title VII is not the one that would be available to him. And in this case, Your Honors, the fact of the matter is it's Mr. The union did admit Mr. Thompson to membership in October of 1998. The union did admit Mr. Thompson to the apprenticeship program The evidence showed, and the court found, that there would be no adverse harm to Mr. Thompson at all. So that, in fact, the assertions that the union, I think it's fair, I think one of the judges asked Mr. Martone, was there lethargy here? There must have been some clerical problems in expediting this, but in fact, in terms of the protections that the contract would have given to Mr. Thompson, he enjoyed all of them. He was admitted to membership. He was admitted to the apprenticeship program. He chose not to attend because Pascal Electric withdrew or attempted to terminate its contractual obligations. And then after that happened, Mr. Thompson simply failed to attend any of the apprenticeship programs. So as far as any, there simply was no effort by the union to discriminate. I mean, we opened our membership to him, we opened the apprenticeship program to him, and he chose not to attend. Mr. Martone focused on the targeting program. Again, there are specific procedures that Mr. Smart was told early on to follow. He never submitted a written form seeking participation in the targeting program, and he hasn't shown that his non-participation in any way injured him. So in fact, there is simply no evidence that the union was motivated in any way by a discriminatory motive.
Let's return for a moment, though, to this disparate treatment with respect to dues payments. I mean, he's basically said the only guy who got singled out for the higher dues payment was the fellow who also had an African-American employee. The only evidence we have before us is two other people who were owner-operators and also working journeymen in the trade, and those two guys didn't pay them. And you folks just simply can't show that's not true.
Your Honors, I think what he's saying is that he is one who had the working dues imposed on him, and that there was no evidence below that there were others who had those dues imposed on him. And what he's saying is he has some information from some sources, not evidence, that there were some other contractors who might or might not. He had some supposition that they were, but there was no evidence admitted below, or no either documents showing that these contractors worked, or any kind of valid evidence that the court found admissible that these contractors were working contractors. I see my light is on. Is there any other questions?
You still have a minute. Go ahead.
Oh. So I don't think that I think the district court correctly found that there was not sufficient evidence to find deny sufficient evidence to deny the union's motion for summary judgment on that issue.
Turning to another matter just for a moment, with respect to the finality of the arbitration award, here there was no determination as to exactly how much was owed.
Correct.
Why is that not a final determination? Why is that still a final determination?
Because in many arbitration awards, there's not a finding of an exact dollars and cents amount, and it's left to a minister. In fact, what the board found is that the party found that he had failed to pay the fringe benefits and simply said parties resolve this. Well, that's a ministerial act. It's a matter of simply computing a very small set of hours versus a rate that's set out in the contract and coming to a conclusion.
Did anyone complain to the arbitrators when they issued their award that, you know, was there one arbitrator or three?
No, this is an arbitration board.
A board.
It's
okay.
A labor management committee made up of management contractors and union members.
Did either side complain to the board, you know, say, hey, guys, you didn't finish?
No.
We asked you to arbitrate this dispute, and you've only done half of it.
Nobody's come back to the arbitration. Nobody came back to the arbitration board and said, finish the job. No.
So they assumed that the arbitrators had done what they were told.
Correct.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hackett.
Thank you.
Mr. Martone?
Your Honors, touching very briefly upon the issue of the finality of the arbitration award, we urge this court to follow the Eighth Circuit in the Peevely case.
I don't understand you, though, because, look, the arbitrators were told to, you know, decide whether Paschal is liable for these dues, and they did what they were told, and they went home. So that's the parties got from the arbitrators what they... I mean, finality usually means that the tribunal is finished with the case.
In this case, Your Honor, the grievance that the tribunal was reviewing was an allegation that Pascoe Electric had failed to make fringe benefit payments. The union dues were not part of the arbitration.
Well, whatever it is, but you didn't go back to the board and say, hey, you guys, you didn't finish. You didn't do what we asked you to do.
There's no provision for us to go back or appeal the award of the board, Your Honor.
They're finished. They're finished. They were finished. They did what they were told to do, and they quit.
In this case, and in university life, this court has ruled that where the calculations necessary to determine damages are more than ministerial, the award's not final. And in this case, ERISA damages, benefit fund damages, are not ministerial.
That's a general rule of finality, and if the arbitrators are told to come up with a number and they don't, it's not ministerial. It means they haven't finished their job. But if they've done what you've asked them to do, even if it's incomplete, how can you challenge them? They've done what you told them, what you wanted them to do.
Actually, Your Honor, we weren't the ones who initiated the arbitration.
Well, whoever. The point is, they did what they were told to do, and they're finished. There's nothing more for them to do.
I'm just going to briefly address two discrimination points, Your Honors, if I may.
If I may ask questions, sure. I think it's central. With respect to question of dues payments, the union offers, in effect, what they say is a non-pretextual reason. That is that your client was a working electrician as well as an owner, therefore he pays higher prices. They now suggest that the other two people involved were not similarly situated. What evidence do you have to establish that is, in effect, a falsehood? That's really what the law requires that you do at this point.
In this case, Your Honor, I'll address each of the two individuals separately. In this case, it was the union's contention that Harold Fitz, one of the two people, was not working with the tools, and therefore he should not have to pay dues. Well, in this case, there's evidence on the record in the form of an affidavit from plaintiff Ron Smart that he saw Harold Fitz working with the tools. In fact, there's a photograph in the record, which is Exhibit 4, not in the joint stipulated record, but in the designated record on appeal of Harold Fitz working with the tools. And so I think that's clear.
I thought he was working for a substantial time.
There's no evidence in the record, Your Honor, that is the criteria. The union bylaws aren't in the record, and Mark Client testified he saw him working with the
union bylaws are not in the record?
I don't believe they are, Your Honor.
So there's no, as far as the record speaks, there is no substantial time requirement?
Correct. And in addition, we've submitted the dues records for Harold Fitz, and the other individual is Dan Wilkie. And again, they submitted dues records for Dan Wilkie. His dues card is in the record.
Seems to me if you were able to produce that, it would have been pretty simple to produce other records of other owner-operators as well to see whether or not any other owner-operator had been.
In this case, we had to approach him on an individual basis, Your Honor. And so what we did was we found two that were different, and the union has offered no evidence to controvert that. Finally, let me address one last point.
But what do you mean offered no evidence? They have an affidavit.
Well, the affidavit doesn't address any specific people, though, Your Honor. The affidavit says, here's our due schedule, this is what we charge, and we have examples where that's not true. And I think we've got evidence of pretext in the record as well. My final point is I think we have a little bit of direct evidence of discrimination, Your Honors. In this case, there is evidence, uncontroverted evidence, that James Nolan, the business agent of IBEW Local 702, referred to Robert Thompson, the employee at issue, as, if the court will pardon my use of bad language, a little bastard. Mr. Thompson is a grown man. He has a family, and I would argue that this court could take that as being analogous to referring to Mr. Thompson as a boy or using a similar epithet.
A little bastard?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, that has nothing to do with race.
In this context, I think it does, Your Honor. Because I think
why do you say that?
because Mr. Nolan didn't know Mr. Thompson. He had no reason to disparage him other than on account of his race. And because of the pattern of conduct where Mr. Thompson was denied membership and denied training, I think it's part of the context. By itself, I would agree.
Had your client put it up to the union that they weren't, that in his view they were discriminating on the basis of race, that that's why, excuse me, that what you've got is catching, obviously.
I apologize.
As to why this gentleman hadn't been called for to be sworn in?
Yes, Your Honor. That's why he withdrew from the union and also terminated his relationship with him.
Did he say it, though, at the time he was trying to get him into the program and get him sworn in?
He didn't believe it at the time he was trying to get him sworn in. He only believed it after the denial, and he said that in the arbitration proceeding.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Martone, thank you to both parties.